with state unemployment agencies waiting for federal guidance on how to put the new legislation in place, it is unclear how quickly those programs could resume and whether the benefits would be retroactive to accommodate the delay. Because unemployment benefits are processed weekly and the legislation was not signed before the beginning of the week, it is likely that workers in most states will lose a week of benefits under the expanded program, as well as a week with the $300 supplemental benefit. They might get it at the back end, but there are bills tomorrow, said Michelle Evermore, a senior policy analyst for the National Employment Law Project and non-profit workers' rights group. It's just so frustrating that he couldn't have figured this out yesterday. One day of delay is catastrophe for millions of Americans. A Democratic aide on Sunday said most states would need guidance from the Labor Department to see if they could pay benefits for the week of 27th of December. The delay also jeopardized the time frame for distributing the $600 direct payments to most American adults, which Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, had initially promised could be distributed as early as this week. For families wondering how they will pay January rent or buy groceries, a weeks-long delay could have serious consequences, Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, the top Democrat on the Senate Finance Committee, said in a statement on Sunday evening. Senator Ron Wyden said, "While it's a huge relief that the bill is being signed, Donald Trump's tantrum has created unnecessary hardship and stress for millions of American families." Donald Trump's signing of the measure came as welcome relief for desperate Americans who had been left on the edge as their unemployment benefits lapsed. Melissa Martinez, a 52-year-old of Westminster, Colorado, said she had applied for more than 50 jobs since being laid off as an operations manager for a transportation company back in April. Like millions of others, her unemployment benefits expired the day after Christmas. "I'll be able to pay my bills. I'm not going to have to sacrifice my credit. I'm not going to have to worry about where we're going to live," she said. "It's a huge weight lifted off my shoulders, a huge weight." Though she is grateful for the aid, Ms. Martinez wishes that President Trump would have signed the bill sooner. "It's a huge deal because we needed it and we were desperate for it," she said. "But we shouldn't have been desperate for a $600 check after 9 months. This is something that should have been done months ago."
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing the Oscar-nominated documentary Last Days in Vietnam, directed by Rory Kennedy. And joining me in the studio, we have Dave Calhoun, who is a film critic with Time Out magazine. And beside him is Lindsay German, who is the founding member and convener of the British anti-war organization Stop the War Coalition. Now, Last Days in Vietnam examines the chaotic final days of the US's presence in Vietnam and their efforts to help evacuate 135,000 South Vietnamese people as the North Vietnamese forces were closing in on Saigon. Featuring contemporary reflections from those who were there, this documentary also shows the moral dilemmas faced by US soldiers and diplomats during the unsanctioned evacuation.
"We today have concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honor in Vietnam. we have adopted a plan for the complete withdrawal of all U.S. combat ground forces. We are finally bringing American men home.
The American troops were gone, and as a result, the house of cards began to collapse.
We were dealing with an ambassador who was just convinced that somehow there wouldn't have to be an evacuation, and therefore there wouldn't have to be a concern about evacuating South Vietnamese.
These people were dead men walking. Sometimes there's an issue not of legal and illegal, but right or wrong. I borrowed a truck, and I drove them to the airbase. I had told them, when you hear three thumps, that means hold the baby's mouths, don't breathe, don't talk, don't make any noise. I was going to get them out.
The final battle of Saigon has begun.
That morning, there must have been at least 10,000 people ringing the embassy.
There was a sea of people wanting to get out. They looked up at the helicopters leaving, and I could see their eyes. That's good eyes.
There are no words to describe what a ship looks like. It holds 200 and it's got 2,000 of them.
We have no more helicopters. That's it.
As it took off, I could see the group right where we had left them. It was just so serious and deep a betrayal. Who goes? And who gets left behind?
Well, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, the U.S. Fought in the Vietnam War for nearly 20 years, from 1955 to 1975. And of course, their alleged role was to stop the spread of communism. But of course, in this documentary, it doesn't really talk about this aspect of the war. More so, it focuses on the last days of U.S. troops in Vietnam, as the title of the documentary suggests. And Dave, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, how would you summarize what Last Days in Vietnam is about, and what was your take on it?
As you say, it's a particularly human story. It looks at the, as the title says, the final days of American involvement in 1975 in South Vietnam, and particularly in Saigon. After the withdrawal of troops in 1973, there were still between 5,000 and 7,000 US military personnel or advisors still in South Vietnam, many of them in Saigon. And what the film does is, using archive footage and new interviews, it builds up a portrait of what happened in April 1975 as those US personnel had to scramble to leave the city and the country, and also what they decided to do or not to do to help those people, South Vietnamese and those living in Saigon, who they knew and who they'd been working with, many of them were in relationships with, or who they considered, some of them considered family.
They were very well integrated into the country.
Yeah, absolutely. So some moral dilemmas that come up through that. I found it a pretty gripping film, actually. It's a micro portrait of this particular chapter in the history of the Vietnam War. I mean, this final chapter is very well put together, and I found it pretty illuminating.
And Lindsay, if I could turn to you now, would you agree with what Dave said? What was your take on this documentary?
Well, I agree with Dave. I thought it was a very good film, and it got across this sort of moral dilemma very, very well. I think my big criticism of it is not about the film itself, and maybe this shouldn't be a criticism of the film, but that the context of what's going on isn't really developed in the way that it should be. So you see sort of pictures of maps that the North Vietnamese are coming and are surrounding Saigon and are just a few hours away and all this kind of thing, without actually sort of looking at the backstory of what happened. So I think it was it's a very well-made film. It's a very human story, because it's about what happens to the people, which can happen in any war where you're on the losing side, and what then happens, and it can be very, very hard for people in that circumstance. And you can understand why both the Americans wanted to get their friends and family out, and also why some of the South Vietnamese thought that if the North Vietnamese came, they wouldn't have much of a future. But I think that lack of context also does weaken the film's message, I suppose, or gives you one side of the message. Mm.
And I want to tear apart, actually, the more on the political context of the film in the next part of the discussion. But just for now, we're going to take a brief break.
Big Chinook showed up. There's no way he can land on Kirk without impacting the ship. He would have killed everybody on the helicopter, plus my crew.
It was way too big to land. We thought that the helicopter would just fly away. But as the ship was moving forward, probably 4, 5, 6 knots, something like that, the pilot communicated that he was running low on fuel.
He opened up the port side of the helicopter and he hovered across the stern to Kirk. Then all of a sudden, here comes a human.
One by one, we jump out. I jumped out, my brother jumped out, my mom was holding my sister. Obviously very scared. And she just trustingly, just with one hand, with her right hand, holding on with her left to brace herself, just dropped my baby sister.
One fellow standing there, and he said he looked up and he saw this big bundle of stuff come flying out, and it was a baby. It was the one-year-old baby. And then the mother jumped out and he caught her too.
There are some really great evacuation stories in this film. And just before we went to that clip, as you were saying, this, from a cinematic perspective, this documentary is a great documentary. And Lindsay, if I could ask you, what evacuation story stood out the most to you?
Well, I like the whole way that they did it. The thing that perhaps I remember most is this thing where they say that there was this signal, which would, when they knew they had to evacuate, which would come on the radio, and I forget what the phrase was, but then they said they would play Bing Crosby's White Christmas, which I thought was perhaps one of the most bizarre things in terms of what was going on in Vietnam, the whole war and everything. So I suppose that really stood out. But lots and lots of people trying to get there, the people, and even with that message, was the message about White Christmas was you have to come with your family to the embassy with only one suitcase, which I guess is a pretty... I mean, all right, you're getting out, but you're getting out with not very much stuff. So I thought they were very moving. And the one about the man who went and got his family, the Vietnamese pilot, who went and got his family in his helicopter and just took the helicopter, went and got his family and got them out. So they were very moving stories, I thought. And they were, obviously people were in a very desperate situation.
Indeed. And according to this documentary, the events described in it includes the stories of some 77,000 South Vietnamese people. And Dave, if I could ask you the same question, what story stood out the most for you?
I mean, I agree. I mean, there's very, very many there. And I agree also, actually, yeah, some of those code slogans and things they hear on the radio are particularly, they do stick in the mind. To be honest, actually, I mean, as well as all the stories of the people that do leave, I mean, some of the stories that stick in my mind are the hints of the people that were left behind. I mean, towards the very end of the film, we see some of those very famous images of people clambering over the walls of the US embassy after the last 11 people are helicoptered away. I mean, one of the many powerful evacuation stories is of the last of the 11 US soldiers are clambering into the helicopter. But there's one person who recalls, a South Vietnamese man who had been a soldier, who recalls how, as soon as he realized Saigon had fallen, it was over, North Vietnamese were all over the city, and he took off his uniform, got rid of his badge, burnt his military identification card, and just to just so he could make it clear that he was just a civilian once again. I think that one story, for me, just sort of powerfully evokes the idea of hundreds of thousands of people left behind who would have had to very, very quickly readjust to a different way of life, potentially with the threat of being of recrimination if they had if it was proved that they had been collaborating with the Americans or had been in the South Vietnamese army.
And now all these stories are very well, but I just want to challenge sort of this heroic narrative, of course, that many mainstream documentaries about the Vietnam War puts across, especially particularly in this documentary, Lindsay. What do you think of this heroic narrative? I mean, it's not in a vacuum. Did the US soldiers have any business being in Vietnam anyway?
Well, I would argue they didn't, and I think most people now, in terms of the 40 years or so since the final fall of Saigon, would argue the same, that it was not a just war, it was an absolutely brutal war, which went on. The French, first of all, fought it because it was their former colony. Then the United States came in. And if you look at what they did, the use of chemical weapons in the form of Agent Orange, which caused massive environmental and human damage. It's estimated that 2 million Vietnamese died, 58,000 US soldiers died. And the US soldiers, I mean, the thing that's very missing from this, and probably accurately it's missing because by that time the regular soldiers had gone, but the soldiers themselves killed many of their officers. It was the biggest sort of mutiny or mutinous atmosphere that the Americans have ever had to deal with in wartime. And of course, many, many soldiers demonstrated when they were back in the States, were involved in the anti-war movement. It was a mass movement. And none of that, of course, comes across. But there was a great sense that this was an injustice, that by the mid-60s, a great sense it was an injustice. And that was reflected not just in the US, in Germany, there were huge demos, in Britain, in all of the Western countries, people were very, very much against it.
That was a very powerful point. And Dave, I'd like to pick up on your thoughts on that also in the next part.
When President Ford went before the Congress, he had two major concerns. The first was to save as many people as we could. He cared for the human beings involved, but they were not just pawns that once they had lost their military power were abandoned. The second was the honor of America, that we would not be seen at the final agony of South Vietnam as having stabbed it in the back.
Congress wouldn't pass it. They said no more, you know, no more troops, no more money, no more aid to the Vietnamese. Well, I had to go into President Ford's office to tell him.
Now, Dave, I just wanted to pick up on a point that Lindsay made earlier on before we went to the clip. Would you have liked to have seen more political context to this documentary, perhaps to expose more of the crimes in the area?
I think it's very good on the micro. It's very good on those final days, those final weeks in Saigon. It's not especially good on the wider context of the war, which, as you said at the very beginning, has spanned two decades. It's not particularly great on the immediate political context, which is hinted at by that clip either. I mean, it reduces the background politics to a fairly simple Ford was willing to provide more aid to the South Vietnamese. Congress said no. You mentioned heroism before. I mean, it does point the finger of heroism towards Gerald Ford as well there. Mm-hmm. And obviously Kissinger was in his government at the time, so obviously has a reason to be pushing that narrative as well. But but at the same time, the film doesn't set out to offer that context. I think I'd have been a bit more dismayed if it offered the context in a more simplistic way or in a more narrow-minded or biased way. And I think it prefers to avoid it, and prefers just to put you into the melee of those final days, and it does that well.
Mm-hmm. And Lindsay, following on from that clip, they showed Henry Kissinger, who was in this documentary, and some would accuse him of being a war criminal. How do you think he was portrayed in this documentary?
Well, I think he's portrayed very favourably in the documentary, and of course when he says in that clip, you know, we were concerned about human life. I mean, it's a slightly grotesque way to talk about it when you think of how many people had died by the time that he was describing this final evacuation. So I think it's kinder to Kissinger than probably history is or will be to him. I think he played a bad role in all of this. And of course, they kept escalating this war. This is what people forget. It's only in these last years that they de-escalated, and even in 75 they're talking about more money going to prop up what was a puppet government in South Vietnam. You know, I think it's quite unsatisfactory at that level, but perhaps not surprising as well. Once you've got Henry Kissinger to interview, which is quite a coup, then you're not going to ask him any challenging questions probably.
And would you agree with that, Dave?
I would. I mean, it would have been interesting to know. I mean, going back to that particular clip there, and again, the film doesn't really set out to offer this context, but it would have been interesting to know more about
the reason why Congress was so opposed to offering more aid at that time. Mm-hmm. I mean, presumably partly because the Vietnam War for the American people had become a massive millstone around the American people's neck, and it was just something that they really wished to put behind them, you know, for many, many valid reasons. But the film doesn't explore that. It leaves those questions begging if you don't bring a lot of knowledge to the film.
Actually, Lindsay, I think that relates to you. I mean, as someone who was inspired into political activism by the Vietnam War, what was the anti-war movement like at that time, and do you think this was affecting Congress's decision?
Well, no, funnily enough, by the time this was happening, the anti-war movement was much weaker than it had been in the late 60s and early 70s, partly because most of the troops had gone, people could see that it was coming to an end, but there was very, very big sentiment against the war, and there was and also the point that Dave makes is right, I think, about the politically people were, it was an absolute millstone around their necks, but also by the mid-70s, the world economy had turned towards very serious recession after decades of boom. Mm-hmm. So of course the Americans were also thinking that we can't really afford this, and it's usually accepted that the Vietnam War was a big driver of inflation in the 60s and early 70s, which led to some of this economic crisis. So I think they just thought, you know, let's get out of here. We've, as the Americans quite often do, we've seen this before and since. Mm-hmm. And
it was a very interesting discussion so far, but we'll just have to pause for now.
Thought of my friends who were killed in action, and I thought, well, is this what we fought for? Is this what the Americans came for? And I didn't have the answer.
I have wrestled with this ever since. I realized that I had become the quintessential American in Vietnam. I had all these causes, all these big things I was doing. I was trying to get the truth back to Washington. I was talking to agents, trying to persuade the ambassador. And I forgot that what was at stake were human lives.
For years after that, I hear that sound in my head, that sound like ch-ch-ch-ch. In the middle of the night, I just to jump up, I thought the helicopter come pick me up. I called it Dream in the Wind.
That's absolutely devastating war. Now, Dave, one of the criticisms you can make of this documentary is that the number of people who have died, the casualties from the war is missing. I mean, it's not until 1995 did Vietnam release its official estimate of the death toll, as many as 2 million civilians on both sides and some 1.1 million North Vietnamese and Viet Cong fighters, whereas the U.S. military actually say that between 200,000 and 250,000 South Vietnamese soldiers died, so it's a fraction compared to Vietnamese statistics. Do you think this is a weakness of the documentary also? Would you have liked to have seen this more?
I think the film struggles slightly actually to know how to end and how to conclude, because it doesn't do that. It doesn't wrap up with a summary of, because these events are the final events of the Vietnam War. It could very naturally then have a conclusion which wraps up the entire history of a two decade conflict, but it doesn't do that. And I think I pretty welcome the fact it doesn't, because it would turn it into something else. I mean, it does deal with high-level politics at some points. You know, it deals with decisions that have to be made by U.S. generals and the U.S. ambassador in Saigon, but it does try to bring it back to the experience of more ground-level, you know, people on both sides, mm-hmm. You know, or Americans and South Vietnamese, wherever it can. I think if it just gave us a load of figures and statistics at the end, it would be a little bit unfaithful to the film it has been before, really. So I think it tries to end on, as we see there, on a more human, a more sorrowful note, and I think it tries to give a sense of, you know, the futility of war generally on the human level. I'm not sure it does that entirely powerfully. I'm not sure it does that as powerfully as it does as it achieves other things throughout the film. But I think I welcome it trying to end on that note,
which is fair enough, I suppose. And Lindsay, I mean, the U.S. lost at least 58,000 troops, and I've read in my research that this is still a controversial issue as to the U.S. narrative is that they didn't win the war, they didn't lose the war. Why is this such a still controversial issue?
I think it's a very big question still in America. I mean, obviously, the surviving veterans and the surviving anti-war protesters come to that are now older. You know, they're now quite old. They're people who are sort of pensioner age and so on. It's still a very contested thing. There's still a very contested thing. Was it justified? There's still many, many veterans who are disabled and who are mentally and physically ill as a result of the war. And, of course, America doesn't like losing wars. I mean, this is Trump's election. You know, he says, we don't mind going to war, but we want to be able to win those wars. And, of course, Vietnam showed them they couldn't win the wars, despite this huge superior air power and military might in general, despite targeting quite deliberately civilians, which they did, who they claimed were sort of hiding the Viet Cong and the people who were fighting. Despite all this, they lost, and they lost because of what the Vietnamese people themselves did. They lost because their own soldiers didn't have the faith in it that perhaps they might have done in previous wars. And they lost because the people at home said, look, we don't want this either. So I think it's still a very big issue in American politics. And, of course, you know, it's contemporary in the sense that there was what was called the Vietnam Syndrome, which did stop these interventions for the best part of 20 years. And now we're back with a vengeance with all of those.
Well, it's very great how to see how it relates to today as well. And I'm afraid we'll have to leave the discussion here. I wish we could talk longer. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thanks to my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Authorities in Tennessee on Sunday, 27th of December, named 63-year-old Nashville resident Anthony Quinn Warner as the perpetrator of the Christmas morning bombing that injured three people and destroyed sections of the city's historic downtown. Anthony Quinn Warner, an information technology contractor from the southeastern suburb of Antioch, instigated and was killed in the explosion, according to law enforcement sources at an evening press briefing. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Richard Luscombe. The piece is titled Nashville Blast, Officials Identify Anthony Warner as the Bomber. Stay with us for more of Richard Luscombe's article. Authorities in Tennessee on Sunday, 27th of December, named 63-year-old Nashville resident Anthony Quinn Warner as the perpetrator of the Christmas morning bombing that injured three people and destroyed sections of the city's historic downtown. Anthony Quinn Warner, an information technology contractor from the southeastern suburb of Antioch, instigated and was killed in the explosion, according to law enforcement sources at an evening press briefing. Anthony Warner is the bomber, Don Cochran, U.S. attorney for the Middle District of Tennessee, said. He was present when the bomb went off, and he perished in the bombing. Investigators matched DNA from human tissue found at the site to samples collected from a vehicle used by Warner, according to David Rauch, director of the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation. Additional identification was made possible from clues found at the scene of Friday's explosion, which took place at a facility owned by the telecommunications company AT&T, and which knocked out or impaired mobile phone services in several other cities. Douglas Korneski, the special agent in charge of the FBI's Memphis field office, said a vehicle identification number found in the wreckage was from an RV motorhome that was used as a mobile bomb and was registered to Anthony Warner. There is no indication that any other individuals were involved, Korneski said. We reviewed hours of security video surrounding the recreational vehicle. We saw no other people involved. Anthony Warner had earlier on Sunday been named as a person of interest into the explosion that took place outside a facility owned by the telecommunications company AT&T and which knocked out or impaired phone services in several other cities. Agents from the FBI and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, ATF, have spent the weekend searching the home of Warner, who once owned a company specializing in burglar alarms. Teams of investigators continue to comb the site of the bombing on Sunday for clues, and a curfew in the center of the city was extended. Earlier, a Nashville television news channel reported that Anthony Warner worked as an IT consultant for a real estate company, Friedrich & Clark. Steve Friedrich, a realtor who contacted the FBI after hearing the man's name on a news bulletin, told WSMV that federal agents had asked him if Warner had a paranoia about 5G technology. Promoted by the right-wing cult movement QAnon, among others, the conspiracy theory makes wild claims about 5G, the next-generation technology that delivers high-speed internet access to mobile phone networks, as well as believing 5G is a spying tool of the deep state. Theorists claim the technology causes cancer and helps spread coronavirus. Research by the Tennessean newspaper, meanwhile, revealed that Anthony Warner registered as the owner of the business Custom Alarms and Electronics in 1993 and was involved in a recently settled legal dispute with his family over property ownership. He was kind of a low-key to the point of, I don't know, I guess some people would say he's a little odd. He was kind of a computer geek that worked at home, Warner's next-door neighbor, Steve Schmalt, told the newspaper. Earlier on Sunday, the mayor of Nashville appeared to indicate that the 5G conspiracy theory could be relevant to the investigation. For all of us locally, it feels like there has to be some connection with the AT&T facility and the site of the bombing. John Cooper, the mayor of Nashville, said on CBS's Face the Nation, that's just local insight because it's got to have something to do with the infrastructure. The mayor of Nashville, John Cooper, has been liaising closely with federal and local law enforcement agencies conducting the investigation, and also the Republican Tennessee Governor Bill Lee, who has asked President Donald Trump for a federal disaster declaration. President Trump, meanwhile, was playing golf in Florida on Sunday, and the White House had not responded to Tennessee Governor Bill Lee's request.
on the news line.
The U.S. is facing another crisis thanks to the actions of the U.S. President Donald Trump. This time, it has to deal with a massive COVID-19 relief bill. Donald Trump said that he is unhappy with the massive bill, which provides $892 billion in coronavirus relief, including extending special unemployment benefits. $1.4 trillion is also needed for normal government spending. The U.S. president said that he is not signing it, in part because that one-off $600 stimulus checks for struggling Americans are not large enough.
I am asking Congress to amend this bill and increase the ridiculously low $600 to $2,000 or $4,000 for a couple.
An increase to the size of the checks was something Democrats attempted to get, but Republicans refused to accept it, throwing it further into doubt the future of any imminent financial relief for millions of struggling Americans. However, the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi plans to hold a vote to approve the $2,000 checks on Monday. Another objection made by Trump was that the bill gives too much money to special interests, cultural projects, and foreign aid.
$600 for the past several months that Americans haven't received any assistance is almost nothing. It's $1.75 a day. And it's quite pathetic, especially when you look at how the rest of the bill gives millions of dollars. It gives $33 million to Juan Guaido. It gives millions of dollars to Israel to regime change measures. And this $600 essentially is going to go to landlords. It's going to go to banks. Americans are going to see that money, and it will be gone in the next moment.
Trump's refusal to sign the bill is not just affecting jobless benefits. A partial government shutdown will begin on Tuesday, unless Congress can agree a stopgap government funding bill before then. The U.S. president's move surprised many, particularly since Trump left nearly all of the negotiations to Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, who made no push for the $2,000 stimulus checks that the U.S. president is now seeking. All through the months-long wrangling between Democrats and Republicans over the stimulus package, Trump did not say anything. He didn't object to the terms of the deal before Congress voted it through on Monday. But since then, Trump has constantly complained about it. If he continues to refuse to sign the bill, more than 14 million laid-off Americans could lose their unemployment benefits for weeks. Even if Trump finally agrees to sign it, they would likely suffer a break in payments. States cannot pay out benefits for weeks that begin before the bill is signed. Now, as a result of Trump's refusal to sign the bill, benefits will not restart until the first week of January, but they will still end in mid-March, effectively trimming the extension to 10 weeks from 11. Moreover, a series of additional relief provisions, including an eviction moratorium, are set to expire at the end of the month. Other temporary relief protections shielding millions of Americans from the brunt of the pandemic's economic toll will lapse shortly after the new year without action. Top officials, including Pelosi and Mnuchin, are now privately discussing plans such as a stopgap spending bill in case Trump formally vetoes the measures by Monday. But it is not clear how long that stopgap measure would last or whether Trump would sign it if it makes none of the changes that he wanted. Trump never said that he would veto the legislation anyway. However, he may not have to. The legislation passed with the support of, well, more than two-thirds of both the House and the Senate, easily surpassing the threshold required to override a veto if he actually did that.
It appears to be a partisan divide. Now Trump is saying he won't sign the stimulus package because it's too low. But we also have to look at the fact that when this bill was signed, it was signed with a supermajority in both houses, in both the House of Representatives and in the Senate. And we gotta also remember that the Democrats now have the majority in the House of Representatives. So because they had two-thirds in both the House of Representatives and the Senate, it really doesn't matter if Trump refuses to sign it or not. Of course, the Congress would hope that Trump signs it and that they can get it done, but they could still veto his veto.
But in this scenario, timing means everything. The legislation can become law 10 days after the bill is enrolled, even without a presidential signature. but because the time frame overlaps with the end of the current Congress in January the 3rd and the convening of the 117th Congress, some called a pocket veto can become a possibility. A pocket veto is a legislative maneuver that allows the U.S. president or another official with veto power to exercise that power over a bill by taking no action instead of affirmatively vetoing it. If that happens, all legislation dies with Congress. So without Trump's signature in the next 10 days, the bill would have to be reintroduced and voted on a second time. This means more delay in funding of the government and providing relief to struggling Americans and businesses.
Yemen is currently the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. Yemeni people are facing a long list of unbearable problems such as daily airstrikes, famine-like conditions, different deadly diseases, and an economy in tatters. Meanwhile, Yemeni children are undoubtedly the most vulnerable part of the population. The situation of children in Yemen has been described as a crisis within a broader humanitarian catastrophe. This week, Yemen's health minister once again raised the alarm about the situation of children in his country. Taha al-Mutawakkili said 3,800 children have been killed in attacks carried out by the Saudis and their allies over the past years. He also warned that the aggressors' bombardment campaign has devastated Yemen's health infrastructure, making it increasingly difficult to save children. The plight of the Yemeni kids has once again come under the spotlight just a few months before the 6th anniversary of the beginning of the Saudi-led military offensive against Yemen. Earlier this month, the United Nations Children's Fund said one Yemeni child dies every 10 minutes from a preventable disease, 2 million are out of school, and thousands have been killed or maimed since 2015. The United Nations has been quite loud in voicing concern about the ongoing crisis, but it is also under fire for removing the Saudi-led coalition this year from a blacklist of child killers. The Saudi-led alliance was first blacklisted several years ago for killing and injuring children in the war.
The United Nations, of course, has this very typical, very endemic weakness, I dare say, being that it's an organization that for a big part is dependent on the world superpowers to really take action. And we have seen in the past that for this reason, it is very difficult sometimes for the United Nations to really come into action, even when a lot of the member states might want to. We have enormous pressure from Saudi Arabia.
It was on March 25, 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its allies, such as the United Arab Emirates, began pounding Yemen from air, sea, and ground. Now another anniversary of the beginning of the offensive is drawing close with no end in sight to the campaign. Why is this war dragging on so long, and why is the international community failing to put an end to it? The invaders launched a bloody offensive in the hope of achieving a quick victory. However, to this day, none of the stated goals of the military campaign have been met, with the Saudi-led onslaught being described as a fiasco. But the invaders are not changing course. They have indiscriminately bombarded civilian areas. Markets, funerals, weddings, jails, medical and water supply facilities have all been hit. This has taken a heavy toll on Yemen's infrastructure and civilian population. Western countries, particularly the United States and Britain, have refused to review their ties with Saudi Arabia over the bloodshed in Yemen. They have instead intensified their backing of Al Saud. The United States and Britain have stepped up their arms sales to the regime despite the human suffering in Yemen. Meanwhile, the United States has provided the Saudi and Emirati forces with different types of military assistance. Critics insist the heavy U.S. military support has made America a partner to the devastating war. Observers believe without Western diplomatic and military support, the onslaught would have ended a very long time ago.
The sworn enemy of the Iran nuclear deal will be leaving office very soon. The U.S. President Donald Trump, who unilaterally withdrew America from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action in May 2018, left no stones unturned to completely destroy the JCPOA. Trump managed to significantly undermine the hard-earned international deal, but he failed to achieve his ultimate goal of killing the deal. Now, just weeks before Trump becomes a former U.S. president, the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal renewed their commitment this week to preserve it. The foreign ministers of Iran, China, Russia, Germany, France, and the United Kingdom agreed on Monday that no party should set fresh preconditions on a revival of the JCPOA. Their statement is believed to be paving the way for Washington and Tehran to come back into full compliance when Joe Biden takes office in January. Trump tried to destroy the deal by imposing tough sanctions and scaring off other countries from doing business with Iran. In response, Tehran has rolled back some of its JCPOA commitments. The next U.S. president will need to remove Trump's favorite sanctions against Iran, and Tehran, in return, will be expected to put back in place certain limitations on its nuclear program based on the JCPOA.
But if they return to the nuclear deal and into full compliance in action, Tehran will do the same by returning practically into full compliance. What is important here is that that return by the U.S. or some other parties to the nuclear deal into compliance, if it happens, theoretically, that will not suffice. What they need to do is that they return practically and in action.
The U.S. president-elect has pledged to restore the JCPOA when he takes office. Will America take this opportunity to rejoin international diplomacy and multilateralism? The running foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, has repeatedly said that American sanctions deprived Iran of the benefits that his country is entitled to under the nuclear deal. Iran's top diplomat says the Europeans share the blame of the irreparable economic harm to Iranians. On Monday, Zarif took to Twitter after the meeting with his counterparts from China, Russia, Germany, France, and the UK. He posted a chart showing how trade between Iran and the EU has gone down over the past years, despite repeated European promises of better economic ties under the JCPOA. Zarif warned that this is the last chance for the Europeans to save the deal. The top diplomat said that Tehran will quickly reverse the measures that it took in response to the U.S. withdrawal and European breaches if they perform their duties well. Iranians are undoubtedly infuriated by the West's failure or unwillingness to properly implement the deal. Recently, Iran's parliament passed a piece of legislation that would prevent UN inspections of Iranian nuclear sites if sanctions are not eased within 2 weeks after Biden takes office. The new law would also require the administration to enrich uranium to the 20% level using advanced centrifuges. Some senior European diplomats, like the UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, said that Iran should not further dilute its nuclear commitments. Some observers believe, however, that instead of lecturing Iran, the EU should immediately focus on how it can properly fulfill its own commitments.
I think the one side that can have demands is Iran, because after the withdrawal of the United States from the nuclear deal, that was Tehran who remained in the deal. Iran showed strategic patience for a year, and after that 1 year, Iran's reduction of commitments happened under the terms of the nuclear deal. So they have done the violation, and the Europeans were, despite their words and promises, were unable to compensate the U.S. withdrawal and exit from the nuclear deal.
Time is fast running out. Iran's top diplomat insists that no democratic country should expect the government to violate the deadline set by the recently approved parliamentary legislation.
It seems that the incumbent U.S. President Donald Trump is keen to leave his mark on the presidency by pardoning some of the most horrific state crimes, with yet more anger raised by his most recent action. In his latest moment of absolution, Trump has officially given a pardon to the private security mercenaries from the so-called Blackwater security firm, a U.S. company shrouded in controversy and shame over crimes committed by its personnel in Iraq. During the incident in Iraq in 2007, four Blackwater security personnel opened fire, threw grenades, and used high-caliber weapons against a crowd of Iraqi civilians, killing 14 innocent, unarmed people, two of which were children. Following an investigation by parties including the FBI, The four guilty Blackwater murderers were sentenced to jail terms ranging from 30 years to life, something that many believe was too lenient, yet others thought were too harsh.
أتمنى من المحكمة الأمريكية بعد ما توصلت إلى هذا القرار القرار الإدانة أن تصدر قرارها بإعدام الجنات لأن هناك ما يقارب 20 عراقي أو 19 عراقي راحوا ضحية.
In spite of the crimes committed by the four men, many people in the US fought to seek a pardon for them long prior to Trump announcing the plan, with the lawyer representing the criminals, Brian Heberlig, suggesting that the four did not deserve to spend 1 minute in prison for their crimes. One can only then question the rationale behind the reasoning of both Trump and the lawyer of the four murderers, especially when it comes to allowing such acts to happen, only for the powers that be allow for the criminals to get away with a crime and the ending of 14 innocent lives. There's a famous song that states that you can get by with a little help from your friends, and it seems that this is very much the case for the friends and partners of Donald Trump. Already Trump has pardoned some highly questionable figures in recent times, with many of them coming from the military or private sector background that enjoy close links to the president. Most recently, Trump has also pardoned Paul Manafort, Roger Stone and Charles Kushner, all close contacts and all sentenced for corruption and lies.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you for giving me the offer. Thank you for saving my life, because I don't think at my age and in my medical condition I would have survived in a COVID-infested prison. The president has said on numerous occasions that he thought there was a good chance I could be exonerated. I agree with that.
But it's Trump's links to Blackwater that raises questions, with Eric Prince, the founder of the company, not only being a close ally of Trump, but has also acted as an official representative of the president in the past, something that clearly shows that there's a link between the pardon and the two close friends. Yet the pardon also comes as no surprise, as in reality, the victims of the terrible crimes committed have all been in US-occupied lands, suggesting that Trump is continuing his discriminatory policy against non-white people, something that Trump has certainly become renowned for over the years. But for Trump, there's no doubt that his famous motto of Make America Great Again has failed, and after 4 years in the White House and his seemingly effortless ability to divide the nation at home and create tension abroad, Trump's true lasting legacy will be MARA, or in its full form, Make America Racist Again, the one impact that Trump has been able to deliver on, it seems.
General Qasem Soleimani was a high-ranking Iranian military official whose popularity began to rise after he led the war on Daesh terrorists on the battlefields in Syria and Iraq. General Qasem Soleimani was the commander of Iran's Quds Force, the foreign arm of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. He was of great help to Syria as an advisor and organizer of Syrian troops when Daesh and other Takfiri terrorists launched a bloody assault on Syria in 2011. He also played a key role in creating Iraq's Popular Mobilization Unit, also known as Hashd al-Shaabi, in 2014. When Daesh declared its caliphate in Iraq and overran several provinces there. Hashd al-Shaabi later managed to defeat Daesh and drive the terrorist group out of Iraq. These victories for Syrian and Iraqi forces further increased General Soleimani's popularity among the Iraqis, Syrians, and Iranians. When General Soleimani declared the end of the Daesh Caliphate in 2018, the United States, which called itself the savior of the Iraqi and Syrian people, described him as its arch enemy and an obstacle to peace in the Middle East. The U.S. imposed sanctions on Soleimani. The Israeli regime also put Soleimani on its so-called terror list. In the year 2020, the assassination of General Soleimani and Hashd al-Shaabi's commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in a U.S. drone strike raises a key question. Was the United States really fighting Daesh? Or as U.S. President Donald Trump himself has said, was Daesh created by his predecessor Barack Obama? Perhaps now it would be easier to answer this question after the assassination of General Soleimani. What is clear is that the United States has killed a man who played the biggest role in both eliminating Daesh from the region and isolating Washington. Following this terrorist attack and the martyrdom of a group of people who had fought Daesh and other Takfiri terrorists round the clock, the question is, who really wants peace and stability in the region? And who is after igniting a war to plunder the Middle East?
In the limelight.
Britain has clinched a narrow Brexit trade deal with the European Union, ending months of disagreements over fishing rights and future business rules. The post-Brexit trade deal was reached on Thursday, 24th of December, just a week before the UK exits one of the world's biggest trading blocs in its most significant global shift since the loss of the British Empire. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson held a press conference and confirmed the agreement, which means it escaped a chaotic finale to a tortuous divorce that has shaken the 70-year project to forge European unity. Boris Johnson called on Britons to make the most of what he called the country's soon-to-be status of a newly and truly independent nation. A deal had seemed imminent for almost a day, until haggling over just how much fish the European Union boats should be able to catch in British waters delayed the announcement of one of the most important trade deals in recent European history. The United Kingdom formally left the European Union on 31st of January, but has since been in a transition period under which rules on trade, travel and business remain unchanged until the end of this year. We'll prepare for you an article written jointly by Molly Blackall and Nadeem Badshah. The piece is titled Johnson urges Tory MPs to back Brexit deal as full text published. The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. Stay with us for more of Molly Blackall and Nadeem Badshah's article. The European Union and the United Kingdom government have published the full text of the Brexit trade deal less than a week before it is due to be implemented. As Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson urged his backbenchers to support the agreement when it reaches the House of Commons next week. The deal, which comes to more than 1,250 pages, will be voted on in the House of Commons on Wednesday, 30th of December, just a day before the Brexit transition period ends. The Prime Minister urged Conservative Eurosceptics to back the deal, saying it made good on every one of our manifesto commitments, and he implored them to remember what the public wants us to do. With Labour Party's backing, the deal is likely to be passed, but Boris Johnson is keen to win over the European Research Group, a parliamentary pressure group of hardline Conservative MPs who want a clean break from Europe. The group has said it will reconvene what it describes as its Star Chamber, a panel of lawyers who scrutinised former Prime Minister Theresa May's withdrawal agreement in 2019 to examine the trade deal before deciding whether to back it. The chairman of the Star Chamber said its examination of the deal was underway. Sir Bill Cash said he was in the constant communication with the rest of the group, having received the full text of the treaty by courier from No. 10 Downing Street on Boxing Day. In a WhatsApp message sent by Tory MPs, Boris Johnson said he was confident the deal would withstand ruthless legal scrutiny from the Star Chamber legal eagles.